reasonably big turnout. Even if there's three people, it's still good enough for me. So we've got one moderate length and two short ones, but if anyone wants to go over another one at the end, make it worth our while. So if you can think of anything whatsoever, just take these two volumes at any time and just dial it up, and then we'll just go over it slowly so you've got time to do some input if you choose. So you can take those two volumes at any time. So we'll start with the counterfeit of the True Dharma, which is Samyutta 16, page 680 to 681. So I'll read it through, and then I'll just stop here and there, just in case you want to make some input. And I basically, while we're doing this sort of formulation, I won't give any input until. If you want to interject, just indicate, and I'll read it through, and then you can basically give me your input, and then I'll tell you what I think at the very end. So basically, I don't sort of rob you, so to speak. So, counterfeit of the True Dhamma. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Ananda Pindika's park. Then the Venerable Mahakasapa approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, what is the reason, what is the cause why formerly there were fewer training rules, but more bhikkhus were established in final knowledge, while now there are more training rules, but fewer bhikkhus are established in final knowledge? That's the way it is, Kassapa. When beings are deteriorating and the True Dhamma is disappearing, there are more training rules, but fewer bhikkhus are established in final knowledge. Kassapa, the True Dhamma does not disappear so long as a counterfeit of the True Dhamma has not arisen in the world. But when a counterfeit of the True Dhamma arises in the world, then the True Dhamma disappears. Just as, Kassapa, gold does not disappear so long as counterfeit gold has not arisen in the world. But when counterfeit gold arises, then true gold disappears. So the True Dhamma does not disappear so long as a counterfeit of the True Dhamma has not arisen in the world. But when a counterfeit of the True Dhamma arises in the world, then the True Dhamma disappears. It is not the earth element, Kassapa, that causes the True Dhamma to disappear, nor the water element, nor the heat element, nor the air element. It is the senseless people who arise right here who cause the True Dhamma to disappear. The True Dhamma does not disappear all at once in the way a ship sinks. There are, Kassapa, five detrimental things that lead to the decay and disappearance of the True Dhamma. What are the five? Here the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, male lay followers and female lay followers dwell without reverence and deference towards the teacher. They dwell without reference and deference towards the Dhamma. They dwell without reference and deference towards the Sangha. They dwell without reference and deference towards the training. They dwell without reference and deference towards concentration. These, Kassapa, are the five detrimental things that lead to the decay and disappearance of the True Dhamma. There are five things, Kassapa, that lead to the longevity of the True Dhamma, to its non-decay and non-disappearance. What are the five? Here the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, male followers, female lay followers dwell with reference and deference towards the teacher. They dwell with reference and deference towards the Dhamma. They dwell with reference and deference towards the Sangha. They dwell with reference and deference towards the training and concentration. These, Kassapa, are the five things that lead to the longevity of the True Dhamma, to its non-decay and non-disappearance. So what do you people think? Have you got any personal viewpoints, angles, objectives? Don't be afraid to say anything whatsoever. And Lynn?
Mm-hmm. really interesting.
Sorry, I can barely hear you. Do the lay...
Is it better?
Is it switched on? Just wait till maybe the other mic, just see how you go.
Yeah, it's just your voice is a bit
soft. Voice is a bit soft.
I just think it's very interesting to see in this sutta that our role as lay people is important in keeping the Dhamma alive in the world.
It's exactly right, because you've got this dependent relationship between the lay disciples and the monastics, and essentially we can't survive without each other. In this particular tradition, the Theravadan tradition, we maintain the dependency, maintain the connection, because you find that overall the training on both sides maintains its effectiveness, because what happens is when you've got the dependency relationship, you've got essentially a core principle is you've got the checks and balances in place. So if the monks and nuns are training properly, behaving themselves, fulfilling their obligations, and are quite reasonable role models for the lay Buddhist community, then you will always get enough support to keep the communities going, to pay the bills, to cover the building projects, any kind of infrastructure, basically whatever kind of formal community engagement, interaction activities, you're able to sustain that for the maintenance and the growth of the both the facility. Because the thing is that even though we have the monastery there, the monastery's there for all Buddhists, but not only the Buddhists, because on the last Thursday we had a visit from the Sikh community, and these people, they're in the more not old, but in the middle age to older age group. You're looking at like minimum mid 50s up to 70 odd, and these people are quite focused and they're quite dedicated as far as their Sikh culture and religious training. But with these people, they're very keen on meditation, and they don't have the kind of very broad understanding, the tools, the experience, knowing how to work with the practice, the way the Buddhists do. They do with the Sikhs. They do. They spend a lot of time on, contemplation, religious contemplation of their teachings, their Sikh Dhamma, so to speak. Which is still quite reasonable. It can be quite effective, but they don't have that very broad base, very broad perspective that we have with the, especially on the meditation side. Because when it comes to meditation, we know it all. We know more about meditation virtually, than any other culture in the world. So, but what's happened is these people, they're quite keen to come up, so there'll be at least a handful after rains will come up. So I just let Chunda know that they can pop up. They've done this kind of contemplative meditation, probably some very, mantra formulation, mild, parikama style practice over quite a number of years. So, you can basically just have them up there for a couple of days, but these people in themselves, they're quite, even though you can see culturally they're very focused on their own particular style, a religious style and practice, that they're very, very keen, very keen to learn different meditation practices and actually incorporate it within the Sikh culture. But the people in themselves, they're quite nice, quite nice people. They come across, they were quite serious, but these people, they're not to be underestimated, because the questions, I've only done one session with these people, and the questions that they asked were easily the toughest questions I've ever come across. I haven't done a lot of teaching in the local or fraternity, local fraternity or extended boundaries, but these people, very intelligent, and their ability to actually investigate, asking really, really sharp, almost, I wouldn't say challenging, but the kind of quite deep profound questions and engaging dialogue. You know, it seems that they seem to develop that as a skill because they've got a main meditation practice which is based on investigation and inquiry into their own spiritual teaching. They've got this sharpness. You know, when I was talking with them, some of the sharpest dialogue I've come across for quite some time. And that, you know, they want to know why the monastics don't work. You know, how we keep the monasteries, monastic communities rolling. You know, how we conduct ourselves as far as community etiquette. What's the relationship between us, between the monastics and the lay community? And some quite interesting sort of challenging questions, which is quite good. You know, if I want to test any of the junior monks, you just put them in a group with these people. It'd be quite interesting. But maintaining that state of dependency. So if the monastic communities are fulfilling their obligations, responsibilities, you can get enough support to keep the communities rolling. And on the lay fraternity, you know, the role of the monastics is to, you know, support the general community with their practice, help, you know, keep people on track, focused, you know, if they have any difficulties or whatnot, you know, within the teaching group, you know, trying to deepen people's understanding of Buddha Dhamma. But I probably only gave you about 50% there, Lynn. I just sort of lost my track. Yeah, because the thing is, you know, with the lay disciples, I always push this to on a regular basis is, you know, just, I mean, it's more of an Asian cultural nuance, but you know, with any of the lay disciples, whether they're Asian or Western, I always have this tendency to push people at least to a small degree with their personal practice. You know, just don't think about generosity in the five precepts. I mean, really make a decent effort within the limit of your faculties to develop, you know, the full aspects, the full foundation principles of the training. Because, you know, even if I was in, I mean, I wouldn't be crazy enough to go back to lay life. I mean, I just can't see the point. The way I see it, even if I was in lay life, that, I mean, I would really be paying a lot of attention to sharpening mindfulness and investigation. You know, I would keep the precepts as best as possible. But all the underlying factors with energy and developing skill in contemplation and developing certain like perceptions. You know, I'm really doing a lot of, I spend like a couple of hours on developing the perception of emptiness, which I find quite good. So whenever I teach any of the lay disciples, I always push that, you know, look at the big picture. Just don't settle for, you know, just sort of bare foundation principles, because, you know, you can easily draw in many of the, you know, you've got 37 enlightenment factors. And you know, it's a good idea to draw as many of those in as possible, and you know, to even actually use them as a contemplator. I knew one Sri Lankan person who would actually go right through the full sets, and he would go right through the 37 factors, and he would investigate each one, because this guy was highly intellectual, almost bordering on sub-brilliant, and very very sharp mind, sharp as a razor. And he would go through each factor, and he would analyze and investigate it till it was exhausted, and then he would move on to the next one. He would just do that continually for a full hour, or so at a time. And he found that practice quite rewarding. I mean, he found that it gave rise to energy, gave rise to faith. And he kept sharpening his understanding, because every day or every second day that he did that, his knowledge and insight kept increasing. You know, he may have had difficulty getting peaceful, but for him, that particular tool, that approach to Dhamma was quite quite useful. And the thing is, with all of us, you know, we have a limited, very limited time span. You know, any of us can be taken at any time, you know, even the monks. You know, there was a young monk at Achan Dans. He only had four reins, young guy, early 20s, and took a fall, you know, he passed out. He had a cerebral embolism or something like that, and he fainted. He cracked his skull on the bench top, on a marble top, you know, cracked his skull, and has some severe head injuries, and he died very quickly. So, you know, accidents happen. Things get very, you know, rare diseases, isn't it? And, you know, a person, you know, because I do so many funerals, and I see the age range from babies through to very, you know, people in their 80s, and you know, things happen. You know, one of our Anagarikas, his grandma, she had a stroke, and they didn't find her till 3 days later, and she had severe brain damage, and she was incapacitated in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. And she lived out her years in a reasonably nice nursing facility, but that's not the point. You know, she was like late 50s, and quite a sharp woman, very socially engaged, and she read and studied, and you know, quite an interesting person, her personality. And her character in general, and then her life, you know, with that stroke, because they found her 3 days later, you know, the severe brain damage took place, and she was essentially in a vegetative state, you know. So little things like that. I mean, it doesn't happen on a, you know, you don't see it that often, but people, you know, they should never ever get complacent. That, I mean, you know, things happen, accidents happen. Car accidents, you know, God knows what else, and your life can just be cut short, you know. Even, you know, I mean, even the people in this room, one of you could be dead within 12 months, you know, even myself. It's quite possible to, you know, people, you know, trucks, you know, in cars, buses, planes, you know, accidents happen. So it's worth, you know, you maximize within the limits of your capability, the limits of your personal life, family life, you know, your work commitments. But you maximise the input, because you know, you may be in a situation where you can't put forth that kind of energy, both either physically or mentally. And then, you know, if you're caught in that situation where things go wrong, that you've got, you don't have to be afraid. You know, you've given it full commitment, and even if, you know, things go wrong, you know, life gets taken prematurely, that you're in a very, very safe perspective. But, yeah, you know, so in the monastics, they have, you know, you have more suitable conditions. You've got the time, you know, like, you know, we're pretty lucky. We only work at present, you know, we've got a big community. We're only working 4 mornings a week. You know, some of us, we have to do stuff in the afternoon or whatnot. But, you know, you've got very good supporting conditions, but you can still work the practice to a very... quite a good degree, even in lay life, if you know exactly how to set yourself up. You know, you look at your enlightenment factors, and that's why I put emphasis on those two, that, you know, the mindfulness and those first two, mindfulness and investigation of dhammas. You know, joy does arise that when you're actually investigating, and you're stimulating mental energy, you get energy actually being stirred, and you get energy starts to roll in the mind. You know, it's when people, they can see that the investigation of dhammas, it's becoming active as a principle. But, you know, all these little tricks that I teach people, like, you know, just using a meditation word, once every 30 seconds and then do it 16, 18 hours a day, and then do your wisdom practice in that space between the mantras, or use awareness of colours or sound, anything which sharpens your mindfulness and where you feel comfortable, you can function, you can think and remember without difficulty, you know, especially if you're working full time, you know, driving a car, you're within a safe parameter, you can function in your day-to-day life, but you can, you know, sharpen the mindfulness to its greatest degree, and then bring the especially those two are easy to work with, mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, and then come to at least a theoretical understanding of the others and actually pull them into the practice and then just work it to the best of your ability.
Could you please explain how you can investigate the color?
Developing increasing awareness of color. It's a skill that you actually develop. So as even here, you know, just sitting here, especially trees and forests, it really stands out for me. But you actually do it as a perception you develop in the mind. So you just sit in a suitable environment and just it's a tool. It's a training. You develop just you. It's more like noticing. Increase your ability to notice. So it's hard for me to explain in words, but it's something like when you're looking in the natural world, and when you're looking around, actually pay attention. The bottom line is you pay attention. You know, say for example, if I'm looking at you, and then you just the redness of the jacket or the blueness of the carpet. You know, really, really pay attention to it. Not just, you know, sometimes we can be very laissez-faire and we can just cruise around and whatnot. And a lot of the time we don't really notice things. But you develop it as a skill within yourself, and it definitely does get, you know, sharper over time. You know, so it's like that principle with sound. You know, with the charm practitioners, they listen to the ear base, and they focus on developing sensitivity to sound. But some people are comfortable with that one, some not. But the color principle, you know, it's a matter. The bottom line is paying attention, and then the sharpness, the increasing awareness follows on after that point. So you're looking at applying mindfulness within that particular area. But you can do it with things like what else could you do it with? Even things like smell. Or you just focus on the sound of your body as you're moving around. Don't bother. You don't necessarily have to listen to things outside, but it will still come in. But as you're moving around and doing things and whatnot, actually listen to the rustle of the clothing and the sound of your voice and whatnot. If you want to keep the mindfulness, you know, within the feel, one's closer to one's personal feel, you focus on the sounds, the audible sounds you make. Or some people, they meditate on the sound of their heart. Some people have an inclination for that practice, you know, because you're drawing your attention inwards, you know, into the heart, and it increases one's sensitivity. So you can experiment with these practices for I'd say like a week at a time, and then see what actually works for you, because you know, some you may be very comfortable with, some you may not like whatsoever. You know? But it's all within the field of mindfulness training. Yeah, so there's also this point, this note 219, which was in relation. Actually, no, I got, that was a later one. Yeah, so that business, yeah, so I don't lose that point with the with this particular sutta, there was two points I came up there with. With the right in the beginning, the one of the reasons why when the Buddha actually first began his teaching career, that many of the disciples, both on the male and the female side, they attained to Dhamma very, very quickly in relation to the people who came after. So what happens was, with the whole formulation of the vinaya, the monastic discipline for the both for the monks and the bhikkhunis, was that in the beginning stages, the people who were in the Buddha's like inner circle were those group of people who become enlightened, say initially first generation of disciples who attained enlightenment in the beginning after the Buddha began to formally teach. And but those people, they weren't just mainstream people, they were people who had very strong parami, you know. So when you look at the first five disciples of the Buddha, and they all attained within a fairly short space of time. I think the time span, I don't know the exact time span, but it was well within, it was under 12 months for sure. And getting enlightened with a stanza of Dhamma. So you just imagine if someone enlightens you just by repeating a few lines. You know, these are not normal people. These are people with really very, very powerful parami, who are right on the edge. They're just ripe. They're just ready. They're just ready for penetration and for realization of the truth. And because the Buddha was so, because of his incredible wisdom and his understanding of people's faculties and characters, that he could see exactly what that person needed in order for them to break through. And he was able to size people up very, very quickly. And he could probably spend a couple of, this is just an inference, but he could spend a couple of minutes with a person, and then he could see potentially what he needed to teach that person in order for them to realize the Dhamma eye. It might sound quite incredible, but because the Buddha was the highest ranking master, within the Buddhist tradition, his parami was at its peak. Right across the board, the spiritual paramis, the faculties, the psychic ability, things like mind reading and the ability to understand personality and whether people were of slow, fast intellects, and he knew exactly how to approach a person to assist with a breakthrough. But what happened was, so they would say, like, you for reference, for the first generation. And those people attained very, very quickly. But because of their own personal development, these people had a natural sense of imbued sila, morality. They were people who didn't require constant admonition, instruction. These are the kind of people who just made very, very few mistakes. Their personal etiquette, the community and personal etiquette was at quite a high level. And when the Buddha was working with these people, when he had these people in his, say, as first generation disciples, that they created very few problems within the communities, because of their high personal development. So very few training walls were actually laid down during that time span. But at a later date, as the Buddha became more famous, that he drew more and more people into his sphere of influence, and then more people were requesting ordination. And then as you get people coming from, many different localities, even other provinces, within the state of within the borders of India, that you were What's the right words? You had a people with a much more broad spectrum of personal karma, conditioning, personal, you know, their own defilements, and personality characteristics. So after that point, I can't put a kind of time span on it, but possibly after, say, you know, when you, the feel that you get with the suttas is after several years, that the quality of the people that he was working with, that he was instructing, that he was assisting with the breakthrough, the quality of these people actually decreased. You were getting more, quite good people, but more like mainstream. You know, in the beginning you had the cream, and then after that you get people of possibly, say, like middle rank. And so with these particular individuals, they had to work a lot harder, they needed more teaching instruction, and the Buddha, when there were errors, there were mistakes made within the community dynamics, interpersonal behavior, the Buddha had to lay down guidelines, you know, they had to lay down rules for the essentially for the maintenance and integrity and harmony of the community. Because even on the with the monastics, like some people, they feel quite, I mean, not necessarily in our monastery, Achyam Brahmali is very good with the vinaya instruction. He knows, his vinaya knowledge can easily match Achyam Brahm's, possibly even he may even know more than Achyam Brahm. But Achyam Brahm's got very experiential. So when he talks about vinaya or dhamma, you know, he's got a very, very strong feeling sense. He's got it coming from the wisdom basis. And naturally, I mean, you know, Achyam Sujata Brahmali, the Kavi, the Pali class, the Sutra and the vinaya. But I mean, if those two weren't around, I mean, I would be doing it myself, and naturally I'd be getting better as I went along. But as time went on, and the quality of the people decreased, you know, coming into the Buddhist circle, number of training rules increased. You had situations where if you get larger and larger communities, you get more people, you get more business, more interaction, more socializing. And when it comes down to tin tacks, if you really want to get enlightened in this life, essentially in the West it's very difficult. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but if I saw a second, you know, I mean, we don't have any doubts about Achyam Brahm. But if I saw a second person actually get enlightened in this country, I'd be pretty amazed, you know. Because the thing is that when you look at the chronology, you look at the way the Buddha did it, you look at the way the old masters from Thailand, you know, Burma to a degree, I'm not familiar with the Burmese circle. You've got enlightened people in Sri Lanka as well. But the way when you look at the life experience of these people, they did it alone, or they did it with a small group of people, and they kept themselves right apart from mainstream society. They didn't teach. I mean, it may not necessarily be accord with your own views, but essentially they didn't get involved with teaching, projects, social engagements to any great degree. They kept themselves isolated. They kept themselves apart from people, and they didn't come out until they actually at least reached that first level. You know, once you're at the first level, you know, as the Sotapanna, you're absolutely secure. You can travel the world, you can do whatever you like. Basically, you're absolutely secure as far as Dhamma is concerned. But in essence, you look at the life histories and what it takes, and you know, that's the reality. That's what it takes. If you want to attain in this life, the only way you're going to do it really is you've got to go to Asia. And Sri Lanka's got very good supporting conditions. You can actually live alone, or you can live in a small group where you're at least maybe half a kilometre or a kilometre away. Things happen, you know, people have accidents, they get sick, they get bitten by snakes and or whatnot. So, but, you know, that will maximise your potential, because especially on the level of meditation, you know, you've got to have solitude. Many of the Western meditation monks, they can hold it together, but it's very, very difficult to, you know, once you're in the teacher's position, if you haven't got the samadhi virtually mastered, really, most people they just can't hold it together. You don't have any choice. You have to protect yourself to a really constantly you have to protect the mind. Not necessarily, you know, it's not like a personal thing, protecting yourself from other people, but it's your own defilements, because the more you engage people, the more, you know, you're out in the world, you're doing this, doing that, travelling, you've got this constant sensory impingement, and it's stirring up the underlying defilements in the mind, and it just means you have to work a lot harder, you have to become more skillful. And it actually makes it more difficult. Even for myself, I'm really not concerned with these things anymore, because I have a personal limit. I don't do more than 3 or 4 hours a day, and that's my limit under any conditions. But I've got this mindset, and I'm very confident in this one, that the next life, you know, especially, you know, for you people who have been long-term practitioners, or the monastics who lived the life correctly, the vast majority of these people are reborn in the Deva realms, and you just make your intention very firm. You pick the practice up, you keep going. As soon as you take the next rebirth, you keep practicing Dhamma, you keep sharpening the meditation, the wisdom faculty, the full spectrum of the enlightenment factors, because it's the incredible time span. The last time I think from memory, it was about 7, I haven't double-checked it, but 7.9 million years, and that's just the first Deva realm, the realm of the four great kings. I mean, I've said this many times, but, you know, this is, for me, I find this very, very encouraging, and it gives me a lot of confidence, because even though I have this sense I won't necessarily make it in this lifetime, but I can almost guarantee, I'll break through on the second life, because it's as long as the mind is strong, the intention is very firm, and you don't lose that, and you hold your ground, that second life, because of the incredible time span, you know, I really believe the vast majority of people, if their intention is strong, that they will break through on that second life, just because of the incredible time that you've got. You just imagine, you know, 7.9 million years, you know, that's the full lifespan, maybe shorter for some people. But, yeah, you could really, I mean, do an incredible, incredible amount of personal practice.
It's not the four elements outside, but it's senseless people who arise right here. So it's just saying that it's not outward conditions, it's conditions within people, it's their attitudes that bring about the counterfeit of the Dhamma.
Yeah.
So what example is, when the Muslims invaded India and wiped out the most of the victims, how does that match that?
How does that what?
How does, if it's just senseless people who arrive, brings about the Dhamma.
Yeah, destroyed the Buddhist culture and killed many of the people practicing in the monasteries.
Was there senseless people there that had to be?
Well, you've had them all the time. You know, if you want to look at examples, you have people, so-called Buddhists, actually inside both the monastic and lay communities. If we want to look at the full spectrum, you've got people teaching things which are not in line with Dhamma, which are not in line with Vinaya, both on the lay and the monastic side. And this is why, you know, especially Ajahn Sujato Brahmali and myself, you constantly keep referring back to the suttas again and again and again, because if you just follow your own views and opinions, which can be just completely deluded, you know, a person's just got to sit down and watch their mind, just watch their thoughts for 5 minutes, and just see some of the crazy stuff which goes on in there. And then you just see what delusion is really, really made of, just at the surface level. And those defilements are right, you know, they're right through the personality. They compose the personality. And this is why, you know, for people who destroy these, without making it sound too impersonal, but who actually destroy these underlying defilements in Kalesa, as an arahant, the ego doesn't exist. There's no sense of self, because the whole business from start to finish, it's defilement. But all of us, because especially with the wisdom faculty, we're moving, you know, we've got enough nouns, we've got enough understanding, where we're moving in a direction where we're moving from the unwholesome. You know, we're good people, we have a sense of awareness, a sense of understanding, wisdom. We see the value of this path, the value of Buddhist culture. And, you know, the value of compassion, kindness in the world. You know, a lot of it's common sense principles, you know. Because, you know, you just got to look at some of the crazy things some of military political leaders are doing around the world and to see the extent of it. But so what happens is, for all of us, we've moved, you know, it might have taken a couple of lifetimes to reach this point, but we're moving from the unwholesome, we're moving towards the wholesome, you know, that we're moving in that direction. So, you know, you can do that in many, many different ways with the practice, and then we reach a point where we move from the unwholesome through to the wholesome, to the pinnacle of the wholesome, and then you relinquish both wholesome and unwholesome. You relinquish both love and hate, you know, attachment to wholesome states. You know, the mind of the arahant is just pure Dhamma. You know, when he moves and thinks and speaks, that his mind is an expression, or his or her mind is an expression of Dhamma, and they're coming from a real foundation in Dhamma. But the person, you know, even though there's nothing inside them, it's like watching an incredibly wise puppet, so to speak. You see this external behavior phenomena, but inside there's no one in there driving that. But the mind itself, it's completely in line with Dhamma, the way they live their life, the way they teach. All the impurities are completely removed from the pure chitta, you know, from the mind leading the pure chitta, which is a Dhamma, a higher Dhamma in itself. So. And then you've got, you know, naturally you've got, so within the monastics, if they don't stick with the suttas from start to finish, because you really, you know, especially, you know, if you're in any kind of teaching position, you just do not, whether you're a lay or monastic, you do not trust 100% your personal views and opinions, because, you know, essentially they're deluded. You know, and even with myself, I always keep checking, because I go over suttas every day. You know, I've got text to speech. I read them. I do word search, and I probably spend nothing less than 30 minutes to an hour on suttas every single day. And you get a feel for it. So when you're actually talking with people, like, I don't consider myself to have an incredible knowledge base, but you can feel it. You know, when you're dialoguing, when you're chatting with people, you get a much there's more clarity, because you don't get completely sidetracked and by one's own personal biases, opinions, you know, my personal likes and dislikes. You know, by absorbing more and more sutta knowledge constantly, because there's so much of it, that your views and opinions are essentially influenced and coloured by the Dhamma content. And, you know, you start to think more clearly, you speak more clearly, you know, not to say that person's going to be, their behavior is going to be absolutely angelic on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, it's like you're looking at this conditioning process. So we condition ourselves with the five precepts, we condition ourselves with suttas, with meditation, and then we're moving towards this, increasing wholesomeness and eventually transcending both wholesome and unwholesome, and then breaking through to the path. So now you will see that with some monastics, you've got to be very, you know, people. Some people get into philosophy and mythology and this and that, but you know, my attitude is that you've got to be careful, because these people who were teaching mythology, who teach, you know, people like Jung and teaching archetypes and Sigmund Freud and all these other people, you know, essentially I'm not going to trust what these people say and what they write in their books, because they're not enlightened people. They don't have the right view, which is reliable. You know, especially with the right view of an arahant is quite pure, and you could trust that person to a very, very great degree. You know, what they teach, their advice, this and that. So, but you know, people like to play with all sorts of different views and concepts, and they like to pull it into the Dharma field, you know, into Dharma practice. But you've got to be quite careful, because it can be quite contradictory. Because, you know, I mean, why does that person want to get into that? Why do they want to get into Jungian archetypes? I mean, why do they want to play with that stuff? You know, it's it may be quite interesting, and you know, it's quite stimulating and whatnot. But you know, it's not based in truth principles. And essentially, I don't, for myself, I mean, I don't read broadly. I stick with the suttas. I stick with the forest masters, Ajahn Brahm's teaching. The really solid teachers with a good track record. Was there any other points, Lynn? Or you're right. Yeah. Sorry if I might have gone on a bit. But, yep. Yeah, so if he a good book to get a hold of is Ajahn Tinisro's Wings to Awakening. You know, he's got because he is sutta based. He does use some different words and terminology, but he's well on track. You know, he's done so much study with the suttas, and the material that he writes, you know, it's quite accurate. He doesn't go off very much at all. Sorry. Ajahn Tinisro from where is he now? From the US, from what's the name of that place? Can't remember. What's the name of that monastery? You'll find it easily. Wings to Awakening, the thick volume. Ajahn Tinisro, he's got chapters devoted to the 37 Bojangas, and he gives the quite almost full detail. And with the sutta references, so as he gives, you know, he's quite an intellectual man. He gives his own personal perspective, but he constantly keeps drawing the suttas in. So he basically, you know, he's quite accurate. His teaching format. So check that one out. And naturally the normal suttas. This is the good thing, if you know, for any of you who are really into suttas. You know, because especially like word search, you know, you could get the Kindle suttas, put it on your laptop, put it on your smartphone, your tablet, and then you can find specific things. You know, so for example, you zero in on a particular area and you get the full references through all the four Nikayas. So when you study something, you know, you go right through the four volumes and you get the full detail. It's quite useful. Yeah, Thanisaro. Yeah, but he also, because he gives his books away, I mean, they're very, the actual, cosmetically, they're very nice, the quite glossy publications. So, but he's got the support network to give books away for free. So if the centre was really interested in easily a dozen volumes or more, you can send him an email and then see what he thinks. because it's quite a useful one. Plus the PDF. You know, you've got PDF versions of virtually all his books. You just go to his web. You go to say like dial up. So you could say Ajahn Chah-Mishra books for download. So all those major volumes, virtually the vast majority of his books, even the small publications, which focus on specific dhammas and teaching. Things like the four frames of reference, four stations of mindfulness. He'll do like one of these glossy little books, you know, half an inch thick. But because it's all sutta based, so you know it's accurate to a great degree. And he has many, many, many of those books, and the vast majority you'll find in PDF or HTML. And then you can, you know, if you've got your smartphone, tablet, laptop, you can load it, and then you can word search and you can find exactly what you're looking for. And but yeah, he's got a good range, very good range of material. Yep. Yep. True Dhamma and Dhamma objects. True Dhamma and Dhamma objects. Are you able to clarify that? I don't fully understand you. True Dhamma and Dhamma objects. Are you able to expand that? The five sense bases. All right. What, as far as what, investigation or understanding? So what you would do is, for example, they have the format, the principle where with your sensory experience you have input coming in through the five senses. So just imagine an example would be say the things that you actually see, you know, from moment to moment, and what you can actually pay attention to. This is another field of attention, where as you see things, as you see different people, as you see trees and flowers, see a puppy dog or a kitten cross your path. Actually, you watch your emotional mindset. You know, the way your mind responds towards different objects, because with one's emotional framework. It's a key principle, because with human beings that we need feeling in order to understand. You know, we need emotion in order to be sensitive, to have awareness, and to have raw material for contemplation. So as you get sense experience coming in through the eyes, or say through the ear, you see how that affects you on the emotional level, and you pay attention to that. And develop it as a skill, and you actually investigate it. So that becomes like a field of Dhamma based on the sense bases. And but you know, so that's one field of say investigative awareness. And then you have this other thing with say sound, color, you know, or even emotion, based on the kind of emotional response you get when you hear like different things. You can actually sharpen that, increase one's awareness. But in a general, you know, if a person found that difficult, they could just investigate, you know, their personality, their likes and dislikes, just in a general sense, you know, the way they feel emotionally in a general sense, which is easier to work with, and then you can focus on just one object. It could be you know, any of the five sense bases, or say like a particular enlightenment factor, or it could be something specific, but it's quite sharp. And so the business with the, say for example, sense object and the pure Dhamma is when you draw your attention towards, say, specific Dhammas, like, you know, sets of Dhammas, five faculties, seven enlightenment factors, four right efforts, all the different sets that you see within the 37 bojangas, 37 enlightenment factors. When you investigate those within the fourth foundation of mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, and these are the very, you know, so you're looking at the very the key teachings. You know, as you understand the foundation principles, key teachings, and what you're aiming at is by zeroing in on that particular Dhamma principle. You're trying to sharpen the mind. You're trying to increase the depth of your understanding. Because, you know, say for example, if I spend 5 minutes thinking about the flavor of ice cream, you know, it's not really very useful at all. But if you focus on something really specific, like say for example, you have a nice meal, or you're at a restaurant and you could have like 5-6 course meal or something, and then you just focus on the way just the taste of the food actually affects you emotionally. That's a much sharper mode of investigation. So the principle is especially for people who are quite intellectual, or the mind is very very sharp and fast, you know, they may find that quite useful, because each person, depending on the personality, the nature of the personality, some people have got more ability, say with the four foundations of mindfulness, some people are more successful with the first, some people are very good with investigating mind states, the third one, and but for highly intellectual people, investigation of dhammas, it suits their personality. So you can experiment in different ways, and then you see what actually works for you. So I better get on to the other ones, so you people may be busy. Okay, so Ravi is striving. So that's the and Gutra Nikaya 212, Strivings, the Book of Twos, page 140. Bhikkhus, there are these two strivings that are hard to achieve in the world. What two? The striving of lay people who dwell at home for the purpose of presenting monastics with robes, arms, food, lodging and medicine, provisions for the sick, and the striving of those who have gone forth from their household life into homelessness for the relinquishment of all acquisitions. These are the two strivings that are hard to achieve in the world. Of these two strivings, because the foremost is the striving for the relinquishment of all acquisitions. Therefore, because you should train yourself thus, we will strive for the relinquishment of all acquisitions. It is in such a way that you should train yourself. But we did touch on that reasonably well. Did anyone have any additional viewpoints on that one? I can expand on it a little, to a small degree. So. Yeah. So with the with the striving of the lay disciples, as we did cover a couple of points previously, but if you look at the comparison, relinquishment of all acquisitions, the Buddha was talking about the relinquishment of the underlying defilements in the world, the relinquishment of the five aggregates. So you're looking at the cessation of the defilements which actually block the path, which stop you from breaking through, and the relinquishment of the five khandhas, which is that connecting link in samsara. Then samsara is considered to be the unbroken chain of the five aggregates within your personal experience, the body and the four mental aggregates. When that is not broken in relation with one's Dhamma penetration, continues on, that's considered to be the Buddhist reference, say that's considered to actually be samsara, that unbroken chain of the five aggregates. Yeah, I think we've already covered that one pretty well with some of the material that Lynn broke up. So but that same thing again, yeah, with the lay disciples, you know, just don't be content, you know, just with supporting the monastics, you know, really really work on your own practice to the best of your ability. But with the monastics, because they're doing this full time, you know, they have to aim for that. They have to aim for the goal, you know, to the best of their ability. So I'll move on with the... No one had any extra points on that because we virtually covered that one. So with the next one, in Gutta Nikaya, the book of twos, 130 to 133, aspiring bhikkhus. A bhikkhu endowed with faith, rightly aspiring, should aspire thus. May I become like Sariputra and Moggallana. This is the standard and criterion for my bhikkhu disciples. That is Sariputra and Moggallana. Bhikkhus, a bhikkhuni endowed with faith, rightly inspiring, should aspire thus. May I become like the bhikkhunis, Kama and Upalavana. This is the standard and criterion for my bhikkhuni disciples. That is the bhikkhunis, Kama and Upalavana. Bhikkhus, a male lay follower, endowed with faith, rightly aspiring, should aspire thus. May I become like Chitta the householder and Hataka of Alawi. This is the standard and criterion for my male lay disciples. That is Chitta the householder and Hataka of Alawi. Because a female lay follower endowed with faith, rightly aspiring, should aspire thus. May I become like the female lay followers, Kuchutara and Welukatanki, Nandamata. This is the standard and criterion for my female lay disciples. That is the female lay disciples, Kutatachara and Wijukatantaki, Nandamata. So, have any of you got any personal points on that? Any ideas? All right. So what this, you know, it's with the, yeah. So what I had a little point here that with the, especially with this business with aspiring to be like these very, say, high standing monastics and lay disciples within Dhamma practice. And I think it's quite a useful thing, or quite a beneficial thing, to do that. But with many of us, you know, because we're not supermen, superwomen, we've got to be quite realistic as well. You know, with the vast majority of us, that, you know, easily you've been practicing for 5 years, say 5 to 10 years, and you will have a reasonable understanding with the weaks and strengthens of your personality, how much mental and physical energy you have, how much practice you can do. And the kind of things that essentially, which will completely ruin, you know, your meditation, or create difficulties for you, make it very difficult to focus, develop mindfulness and whatnot. So, really coming to an understanding of your personality, you know, what makes you up, what you're capable of, the kind of approach you should use to Dhamma when you're using like a step by step, you know, principle with the gradual training. So. Yeah, very, very useful, but I tend to have a more, you know, like, even though I'm very, very interested in Nachan Chah's teaching style, you know, had a very, very strong wisdom faculty, that, you know, I would never pretend to be like, you know, even pretend to be like Nachan Chah, because he's basically working at the Superman level, you know, people like Achan Longpo Plien and Achan Dunn. You know, and these people could walk and sit meditate, and they did this for years, walk and sit meditation. I mean, a 10-hour day is just a normal day for these people. And in the rains retreat, they would do up to 16 hours of walking and sitting a day, and they would just do this 7 days a week. And they, you know, during the Panza, and depending how much responsibility they had, and they could live on, you know, they could live on rice and water for. For weeks at a time, and not even that, you know, not even sweat. You know, they could sleep for one to 2 hours. Longpo Plien was admonished by a very senior monk from Thailand when he was teaching in Singapore. Their paths crossed. Longpo Plien was supposedly a Sotapanna at that point, and he wasn't incredibly busy with the Singaporean appointment. And that senior arahant actually admonished him, and when they were talking about practice and whatnot, because they were their meditation monks, that he really felt that he wasn't putting enough. I think he was sleeping when he was with the. I think he was sleeping possibly about four. Possibly when he was with the Singaporean group, maybe 3 to 4 hours a night, and then after, you know, it's quite funny in a sense. It's, I wouldn't say comical, but the teacher admonished him and said, "Look, you know," he said, "you've got to." He said, "You've only got realistically maybe another 30 years." He said, "You've got to put more effort." He said, "Even though you're with a group, you know, teaching form," and he said, "You've got to put forth more effort." So, you know, he cut his sleep time down to 2 hours a night, and you know, he spent much more time in deep samadhi just to compensate for the the lack of mental rest. So, but you know, very few people can do that. I've seen monks in Thailand, you know, reasonably tough guys who cut their sleep down to 3 hours a night, and they're like the walking dead. You know, they're just constantly falling asleep. They can barely hold themselves up. You know, you can use willpower, but the thing is, if you're not getting good results, you know, that particular approach may not necessarily cut the ice. So, with all of you and myself, you know, you've got workable limits. You know, you're strong in some areas, possibly not so strong in others. And you know when you should have an awareness when to push, when to relax. You know, how to practice Dhamma in different ways, you know, using different principles. You know, you've got 37 factors. You know, you've got different ways to sharpen mindfulness, different ways to investigate. So, you know, and Dhamma's it's an incredibly big field. When people first begin to meditate, they think, oh, you know, yeah, watch the breath and, yeah, it's all very nice, get peaceful. But over the years, the knowledge and the awareness, it just keeps increasing and increasing. Meditation especially meditation and Dhamma as well, but it's an incredibly broad field. I mean, what you can know, you know, over the years. And you know, each person has to pace themselves, because I think the key principle is that, you know, if you're going to be doing this for like the next 20, 30 years, or say 40 years, whatever, you know, you want to basically go the distance. Don't burn yourself out, you know, just keep yourself in a comfortable range, and then just keep going, you know, like day by day, step by step, and constantly sharpen, you know, always keep applying the wisdom faculty no matter what you do. You know, try to have the wisdom faculty watching over all areas of your life, watching over mindfulness, watching over the application of energy, watching over sense restraint and the five precepts, because that's where the keep sharpening your personal development, you know. And you do that on a daily basis, you know, like 5 years, you should be in a pretty good state as far as personal practice. Is there any other points at all? So, question one, Russell from Hawaii. Being lay people limited by our secular responsibilities and can't ordain until later in life, which is not by choice, but intent on following the Dhamma all the way through, how do we build upon our conceptual knowledge to develop it into wisdom? While still a lay person, knowing that death could come at any moment, I may not even be able to ordain in this lifetime. How do we build upon our conceptual knowledge to develop it into wisdom while still a lay person, knowing that death could come at any moment and may not even be able to ordain in this life? So with what I encourage people to do is with the different modes of investigation, different modes of Dhamma investigation, that I would encourage people, whatever line of inquiry, whatever questions you ask yourself, or you when you're looking at life, your life experience, your personality, relationships with friends, people you work with, is to try to keep the mode of investigation within Dhamma concepts. So, you know, just the classics. You know, say for example, the three characteristics of existence. Some people they think this is a very, very simplistic kind of perceptive understanding, but it's very, very useful, because when you have the three characteristics with the nika, dukkha, anatta, that you can use this kind of correlation where Anicca, because all universal phenomena, both all mind-body phenomena, is basically is imbued with the three characteristics of existence, that when you investigate one essential principle, you know, I use the principle of a tree, where the trunk of the tree is Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, and as the tree rises up and you form branches, buds and leaves, that you get these dhammas, these insights which actually branch off from the main trunk section, because all the outlying phenomena, the connecting phenomena, is affected by these primary principles, these primary dhammas, and it increases your awareness of dhamma principles. Like I've been working on this emptiness sanya for a couple of months, but it's got an effect where it increases your understanding of other dhamma principles as well, because they're all interconnected. You know, it's like a big jigsaw puzzle. All the pieces are connected together, like in a web. And so when you zero in on key dhammas, it could be things like investigation of the five aggregates, applying the four foundations of mindfulness, that you're sharpening your wisdom faculty, because you're directing your mind actually in line with core dhamma principles. And and when you do this, and you do this for many months, several years, the mind keeps getting, it gets more and more proficient, it gets sharper, it gets faster. You've got this ability to catch mind states as soon as they come up. You know, you're essentially on the job, and you know, you're examining, you're dissecting, you're coming to an understanding of those principles, because as you investigate, you not only develop the ability to actually approach things in different ways. You know, you can analyze and investigate things from many, many different perspectives, but you actually sharpen the speed of the mind, the speed and the awareness of the mind. And because, you know, it's something which is in line with the enlightenment principles, that you know, first factor, mindfulness; number two, investigation of dhammas; number three, energy is set rolling in the mind. And that energy, when people have mental energy, the mind is much more quick, it's bright, it can swap and change, it can, you know, the ability to, the memory tends to be a bit better with mental energy, and naturally the mind speed increases to at least a small degree. And so, you know, you actually develop that as a skill. So, yeah, I would try, you know, make yourself fully aware of key dhamma principles, and then use those as your tools to actually sharpen your your wisdom faculty, sharpen the mind, and naturally, you know, you help to, it does help to increase understanding, increase one's, you know, the ability to let go of phenomena, increase detachment, increase the stability, the equanimity of the mind. I mean, it even increases kindness and compassion, because, you know, if you're investigating phenomena, you develop awareness, sensitivity, you develop wisdom. You know, you can just see the suffering which the difficulties which some people go through. You know, when we did the funeral for Peter on Friday, and I could really feel the grief from Peter's son. You know, as he was. You know, he had his head on Peter's casket, and he was crying his eyes out, you know, and I was standing to the side, and I mean, I wasn't crying myself, but I thought, you know, you could really feel that young man's grief. And you know, and this is a dhamma, you know, even though maybe Peter's family, they're Buddhists, they're good people, you know, all of us are susceptible to this. I mean, I had a dream a couple of days ago where my mother was standing in front of me, and she has epilepsy. She was going into a seizure. She was losing consciousness. My father rushed to support her so she didn't fall, And then my father just he started to fall away, and he fell to the ground. My mother was still standing. My father was laying on the ground, and I rushed forward, and he was just like laying there, like he wasn't like blue, but he was just laying there completely still. And I reached down to check the pulse. I couldn't feel a pulse, and I thought, oh no, you know, my father's gone. You know, he's died. I was dreaming, and I was actually crying in the dream. And when I woke up, I still had the tears rolling down my cheeks. I actually knew what it felt like to lose my father, and actually, you know, to believe that my father had actually passed away in the dream state, and I was deluded, but I could really sense where that young man was coming from when he was you know, when he had, you know, he was laying his head on his father's coffin, and he was crying his eyes out, you know, and I could really feel that, because I had that emotion to a lesser degree during that dream state. But it's quite useful, because when it comes time, you know, it's exactly what's going to happen. You know, with my parents, I will cry when my mother and father die. So, but that increasing sensitivity and awareness, you know, keeping the mind in line with Dhamma principles, with the mode of investigation. And you find that your faculties they will sharpen in a much shorter period of time, because, you know, people can think about all sorts of things, they can, you know, all sorts of useless things which are of absolutely no value. But if you see the quality of your practice increasing with any particular approach, then you know it's working for you. So was there any other questions at all? Okay, so we'll call it an afternoon. Hope you enjoyed yourself. Thank you very much.